He squatted before one of the cabinets that lined one wall and felt through the contents. "You're not a vegetarian, I hope," Barr said. "I'm omnivorous. But what about the association? Have you lost them?" "Looks so. It was extreme range, a little too extreme. Doesn't matter, though. I got all that counted." He straightened and placed the two metal containers upon the table. "Just give it 5 minutes, Doc, then slit it open by pushing the contact. It'll be plate, food, and fork. Sort of handy for when you're in a hurry, if you're not interested in such incidentals as napkins. I suppose you want to know what I got out of the association, if it isn't a secret." Devers shook his head. "Not to you. What Rios said was true. About the offer of tribute?" "Uh-huh. They offered it, and had it refused. Things are bad. There's fighting in the Outer Suns of Loris." "Loris is close to the Foundation?" "Huh? Oh, you wouldn't know. It's one of the original four kingdoms. You might call it part of the inner line of defense. And that's not the worst. They've been fighting large ships previously never been encountered, which means Rios wasn't giving us the works. He has received more ships. Broderick has switched sides, and I have messed things up." His eyes were bleak as he joined the food container contact points and watched it fall open neatly. The stew-like dish steamed its aroma through the room. Duke and Barr was already eating. "So much," said Barr, "for improvisations, then. We can do nothing here. We cannot cut through the Imperial lines to return to the Foundation. We can do nothing but that which is most sensible, to wait patiently. However, if Rios has reached the inner line, I trust the wait will not be too long." And Devers put down his fork. "Wait, is it?" he snarled, glowering. "That's all right for you. You've got nothing at stake." "Haven't I?" Barr smiled thinly. "No. In fact, I'll tell you." Devers' irritation skimmed the surface. "I'm tired of looking at this whole business as if it were an interesting something or other on a microscope slide. I got friends somewhere out there, dying. And a whole world out there, my home, dying also. You're an outsider. You don't know." "I have seen friends die." The old man's hands were limp in his lap, and his eyes were closed. "Are you married?" Devers said. "Traders don't marry." "Well, I have two sons and a nephew. They have been warned, but for reasons, they could take no action. Our escape means their death. My daughter and my two grandchildren have, I hope, left the planet safely before this. But even excluding them, I have already risked and lost more than you." Devers was morosely savage. "I know. But that was a matter of choice. You might have played ball with Rios. I never asked you to..." Barr shook his head. "It was not a matter of choice, Devers. Make your conscience free. I didn't risk my sons for you. I cooperated with Rios as long as I dared. But there was the psychic probe." The Sewenian patrician opened his eyes, and they were sharp with pain. "Rios came to me once. It was over a year ago. He spoke of a cult centering about the magicians, but missed the truth. It is not quite a cult. You see, it is 40 years now that Siwena has been gripped in the same unbearable vice that threatens your world. 5 revolts have been ground out. Then I discovered the ancient records of Harry Seldon, and now this cult waits. It waits for the coming of the magicians, and for that day it is ready. My sons are leaders of those who wait. It is that secret which is in my mind, and which the probe must never touch. And so they must die as hostages. For the alternative is their death as rebels, and half of Siwena with them. You see, I had no choice, and I am no outsider." Devers' eyes fell, and Barr continued softly. "It is on a Foundation victory that Siwena's hopes depend. It is for a Foundation victory that my sons are sacrificed. And Harry Seldon does not pre-calculate the inevitable salvation of Siwena as he does that of the Foundation. I have no certainty for my people, only hope." "But you're still satisfied to wait, even with the Imperial Navy at Loris?" "I would wait in perfect confidence," said Barr simply, "if they had landed on the planet Terminus itself." The trader frowned hopelessly. "I don't know. It can't really work like that. Not just like magic. Psychohistory or not, they're terribly strong and we're weak. Now, what can Selden do about it? There's nothing to do. It's all already done. It's proceeding now. Because you don't hear the wheels turning and the gongs beating doesn't mean it's any the less certain. Maybe. But I wish you had cracked Riosa's skull for keeps. He's more the enemy than all his army. Cracked his skull? With Brodrig his second in command? Barr's face sharpened with hate. All Siwenna would have been my hostage. Brodrig has proven his worth long since. There exists a world which 5 years ago lost one male in every 10, and simply for failure to meet outstanding taxes. This same Brodrig was the tax collector. No, Rios may live. His punishments are mercy in comparison. But 6 months, 6 months in the enemy base with nothing to show for it. Dever's strong hands clasped each other tautly, so that his knuckles cracked. Nothing to show for it. Well, now, wait. You remind me. Barr fumbled in his pouch. You might want to count this. And he tossed the small sphere of metal on the table. Devers snatched it. What is it? The message capsule. The one that Rios received just before I jacked him. Does that count as something? I don't know. Depends on what's in it. Devers sat down and turned it over carefully in his hand. When Barr stepped from his cold shower and gratefully into the mild, warm current of the air dryer, he found Devers silent and absorbed at the workbench. The Siwenian slapped his body with a sharp rhythm and spoke above the punctuating sounds. What are you doing? Devers looked up. Droplets of perspiration glittered in his beard. I'm going to open this capsule. Can you open it without Rios's personal characteristic? There was mild surprise in the Siwenian's voice. If I can't, I'll resign from the association and never skipper a ship for what's left of my life. I got a three-way electronic analysis of the interior now, and I got little jiggers that the Empire never heard of, specially made for jimmying capsules. I've been a burglar before this, you know. A traitor has to be something of everything. He bent low over the little sphere, and a small flat instrument probed delicately and sparked redly at each fleeting contact. He said, This capsule's a crude job anyway. These Imperial boys are no shakes at this small work, I can see that. Ever see a Foundation capsule? It's half the size and impervious to electronic analysis in the first place. And then he was rigid, the shoulder muscles beneath his tunic tautening visibly. His tiny probe pressed slowly. It was noiseless when it came, but Devers relaxed and sighed. In his hand was the shining sphere, with its message unrolled like a parchment tongue. It's from Brodrig, he said. Then with contempt, the message medium is permanent. In a Foundation capsule, the message would be oxidized to gas within the minute. But Dukem Barr waved him silent. He read the message quickly. From Amal Brodrig, Envoy Extraordinary of His Imperial Majesty, Privy Secretary of the Council and Peer of the Realm, to Bel Rios, Military Governor of Siwenna, General of the Imperial Forces and Peer of the Realm, I greet you. Planet number 1120 no longer resists. The plans of offense, as outlined, continue smoothly. The enemy weakens visibly, and the ultimate ends in view will surely be gained. Barr raised his head from the almost microscopic print and cried bitterly, The fool! The forsaken, blasted fop! That a message? Huh? Said Devers. He was vaguely disappointed. It says nothing, ground out Barr. Our lickspittle courtier is playing a general now. With Rios away, he is the field commander and must soothe his paltry spirit by spewing out his pompous reports concerning military affairs he has nothing to do with. So-and-so planet no longer resists. The offensive moves on. The enemy weakens. The vacuum-headed peacock. Well, now, wait a minute. Hold on. Throw it away. The old man turned away in mortification. A galaxy knows I never expected it to be world-shakingly important. But in wartime, it is reasonable to assume that even the most routine order left undelivered might hamper military movements and lead to complications later. It's why I snatched it. But this, better to have left it. It would have wasted a minute of Rios's time that will now be put to more constructive use. But Devers had arisen. Will you hold on and stop throwing your weight around, for Selden's sake? He held out the sliver of message before Barr's nose. Now read that again. What does he mean by ultimate ends in view? The conquest of the Foundation. Well? Yes? And maybe he means the conquest of the Empire. You know he believes that to be the ultimate end. And if he does... If he does... Devers' one-sided smile was lost in his beard. Why, watch then, and I'll show you. With one finger, the lavishly monogrammed sheet of message parchment was thrust back into its slot. With a soft twang, it disappeared, and the globe was a smooth, unbroken hole again. Somewhere inside was the tiny oiled whir of the controls as they lost their setting by random movements. Now, there's no known way of opening this capsule without knowledge of Rios's personal characteristic, is there? To the Empire, no, said Barr. Then the evidence it contains is unknown to us and absolutely authentic. To the Empire, yes, said Barr. And the Emperor can open it, can't he? Personal characteristics of government officials must be on file. They are at the Foundation. The Imperial Capital as well, agreed Barr. Then when you, a Sewenian patrician and peer of the realm, tell this Cleon, this Emperor, that his favorite tame parrot and his shiniest general are getting together to knock him over and hand him the capsule as evidence, what will he think Broderick's ultimate ends are? Barr sat down weakly. Wait, I don't follow you. He stroked one thin cheek and said, You're not really serious, are you? I am. Devers was angrily excited. Listen, 9 out of the last 10 emperors got their throats cut or their gizzards blasted out by one or another of their generals with big-time notions in their heads. You told me that yourself more than once. Old man emperor would believe us so fast it would make Rios's head swim. Barr muttered feebly, He is serious. For galaxy's sake, man, you can't beat a Selden crisis by a far-fetched, impractical storybook scheme like that. Suppose you had never got hold of the capsule. Suppose Broderick hadn't used the word ultimate. Selden doesn't depend on wild luck. If wild luck comes our way, there's no law says Selden can't take advantage of it. Certainly, but... Barr stopped, then spoke calmly, but with visible restraint. Look, in the first place, how will you get to the planet Trantor? You don't know its location in space, and I certainly don't remember the coordinates, to say nothing of the ephemerae. You don't even know your own position in space. You can't get lost in space, grinned Devers. He was at the controls already. Down we go to the nearest planet, and back we come with complete bearings and the best navigation charts Broderick's 100,000 smackers can buy. And a blaster in our belly. Our descriptions are probably in every planet in this quarter of the Empire. Doc, said Devers patiently, don't be a hick from the sticks. Rios said my ship surrendered too easily, and brother, he wasn't kidding. This ship has enough firepower and enough juice in its shield to hold off anything we're likely to meet this deep inside the frontier. And we have personal shields, too. The Empire boys never found them, you know, but they weren't meant to be found. All right, said Barr. All right. Suppose yourself on Trantor. How do you see the Emperor, then? You think he keeps office hours? Suppose we worry about that on Trantor, said Devers. And Barr muttered helplessly, All right again. I've wanted to see Trantor before I die for half a century now. Have your way. The hyperatomic motor was cut in. The lights flickered. And there was the slight internal wrench that marked the shift into hyperspace. Chapter 9. On Trantor. The stars were as thick as weeds in an unkempt field, and for the first time, Lathan Devers found the figures to the right of the decimal point of prime importance in calculating the cuts through the hyperregions. There was a claustrophobic sensation about the necessity for leaps of not more than a light year. There was a frightening harshness about a sky which glittered unbrokenly in every direction. It was being lost in a sea of radiation. And in the center of a cluster of 10,000 stars, whose light tore to shreds the feebly encircling darkness, there circled the huge imperial planet, Trantor. But it was more than a planet. It was the living pulse beat of an empire of 20 million stellar systems. It had only one function, administration, one purpose, government, and one manufactured product, law. The entire world was one functional distortion. There was no living object on its surface but man, his pets, and his parasites. No blade of grass or fragment of uncovered soil could be found outside the 100 square miles of the Imperial Palace. No water outside the palace grounds existed, but in the vast underground cisterns that held the water supply of a world. The lustrous, indestructible, incorruptible metal that was the unbroken surface of the planet was the foundation of the huge metal structures that mazed the planet. They were structures connected by causeways, laced by corridors, cubbyholed by offices, basemented by the huge retail centers that covered square miles, penthoused by the glittering amusement world that sparkled into life each night. One could walk around the world of Trantor and never leave that one conglomerate building, nor see the city, a fleet of ships greater in number than all the war fleets the Empire had ever supported, landed their cargoes on Trantor each day to feed the 40 billions of humans who gave nothing in exchange but the fulfillment of the necessity of untangling the myriads of threads that spiraled into the central administration of the most complex government humanity had ever known. 20 agricultural worlds were the granary of Trantor. A universe was its servant. Already Devers had fumed his way through the manifold complications of a world conceived in paperwork and dedicated to the principle of the form in quadruplicate. There had been the preliminary halt in space, where the first of what had grown into 100 questionnaires had been filled out. There were the 100 cross-examinations, the routine administration of a simple probe, the photographing of the ship, the characteristic analysis of the two men, and the subsequent recording of the same, the search for contraband, the payment of the entry tax, and finally the question of the identity cards and visitor's visa. Dukembar was a Siwenian and subject of the Emperor, but Lathan Devers was an unknown without the requisite documents. The official in charge at the moment was devastated with sorrow, but Devers could not enter. In fact, he would have to be held for official investigation. From somewhere, 100 credits in crisp new bills, backed by the estates of Lord Broderick, made their appearance and changed hands quietly. The official hemmed importantly, and the devastation of his sorrow was assuaged. A new form made its appearance from the appropriate pigeonhole. It was filled out rapidly and efficiently, with the Devers characteristic thereto formally and properly attached. The two men, trader and patrician, entered Siwenna. In the hangar, the trade ship was another vessel to be cached, photographed, recorded, contents noted, identity cards of passengers facsimiled, and for which a suitable fee was paid, recorded, and receipted. And then Devers was on a huge terrace under the bright white sun, along which women chattered, children shrieked, and men sipped drinks languidly, and listened to the huge televisions blaring out the news of the Empire. Barr paid a requisite number of iridium coins, and appropriated the uppermost member of a pile of newspapers. It was the Trantor Imperial News, official organ of the government. In the back of the newsroom, there was the soft clicking noise of additional editions being printed, in long-distance sympathy with the busy machines at the Imperial News offices, 10,000 miles away by corridor, 6,000 by air machine, just as 10 million sets of copies were being likewise printed at that moment in 10 million other newsrooms all over the planet. Barr glanced at the headlines and said softly, "What shall we do first?" Devers tried to shake himself out of his depression. He was in a universe far removed from his own, on a world that weighed him down with its intricacy, among people whose doings were incomprehensible and whose language was nearly so. The gleaming metallic towers that surrounded him and continued onwards in never-ending multiplicity to beyond the horizon oppressed him. The whole busy, unheeding life of a world metropolis cast him into the horrible gloom of isolation and pygmyish unimportance. He said, "I better leave it to you, Doc." Barr was calm, low-voiced. "I try to tell you, but it's hard to believe without seeing for yourself. I know that. Do you know how many people want to see the Emperor every day? About 1 million. Do you know how many he sees? About 10. We'll have to work through the civil service, and that makes it harder. But we can't afford the aristocracy. We have almost 100,000. A single peer of the realm would cost us that, and it would take at least 3 or 4 to form an adequate bridge to the emperor. It may take 50 chief commissioners and senior supervisors to do the same, but they would cost us only 100 apiece, perhaps. I'll do the talking. In the first place, they wouldn't understand your accent, and in the second, you don't know the etiquette of imperial bribery. It's an art, I assure you. Ah, the third page of the Imperial News had what he wanted, and he passed the paper to Devers. Devers read slowly. The vocabulary was strange, but he understood. He looked up, and his eyes were dark with concern. He slapped the news sheet angrily with the back of his hand. You think this can be trusted? Within limits, replied Barr calmly. It's highly improbable that the Foundation fleet was wiped out. They've probably reported that several times already, if they've gone by the usual war reporting technique of a world capital, far from the actual scene of fighting. What it means, though, is that Rios has won another battle, which would be none too unexpected. It says he's captured Loris. Is that the capital planet of the Kingdom of Loris? Yes, brooded Devers, or of what used to be the Kingdom of Loris. And it's not 20 parsecs from the Foundation. Doc, we gotta work fast. Barr shrugged. You can't go fast on Trantor. If you try, you'll end up at the point of an atom blaster, most likely. How long'll it take? A month, if we're lucky. A month, and our 100,000 credits, if even that will suffice. That is, providing the Emperor does not take it into his head in the meantime to travel to the summer planets, where he sees no petitioners at all. But the Foundation will take care of itself, as heretofore. Come, there's the question of dinner. I'm hungry. And afterwards, the evening is ours, and we may as well use it. We shall never see Trantor or any world like it again, you know. The Home Commissioner of the Outer Provinces spread his pudgy hands helplessly and peered at the petitioners with owlish nearsightedness. But the Emperor is indisposed, gentlemen. It is really useless to take the matter to my superior. His Imperial Majesty has seen no one in a week. He will see us, said Barr, with an affectation of confidence. It is but a question of seeing a member of the staff of the Privy Secretary. Impossible, said the Commissioner emphatically. It would be the worth of my job to attempt that. Now, if you could but be more explicit concerning the nature of your business, I'm willing to help you understand, but naturally I want something less vague, something I can present to my superior as reason for taking the matter further. If my business were such that it could be told to any but the highest, suggested Barr smoothly, it would scarcely be important enough to rate audience with His Imperial Majesty. I propose that you take a chance. I might remind you that if His Imperial Majesty attaches the importance to our business, which we guarantee that he will, you will stand certain to receive the honors you will deserve for helping us now. Yes, but... And the Commissioner shrugged, wordlessly. It's a chance, agreed Barr. Naturally, a risk should have its compensation. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette. It is a rather great favor to ask you, but we have already been greatly obliged with your kindness in offering us this opportunity to explain our problem. But if you would allow us to express our gratitude just slightly by... Devers scowled. He had heard this speech with its slight variations 20 times in the past month. It ended, as always, in a quick shift of the half-hidden bills. But the epilogue differed here. Usually the bills vanished immediately. Here they remained in plain view, while slowly the Commissioner counted them, inspecting them front and back as he did so. There was a subtle change in his voice. Backed by the Privy Secretary, eh? Good money. To get back to the subject, urged Barr. No, but wait, interrupted the Commissioner. Let us go back by easy stages. I really do wish to know what your business can be. This money, it is fresh and new, and you must have a good deal, for it strikes me that you have seen other officials before me. Come now, what about it? Barr said. I don't see what you're driving at. Why, see here. It might be proven that you are upon the planet illegally, since the identification and entry cards of your silent friend are certainly inadequate. He is not a subject of the Emperor. I deny that. It doesn't matter that you do, said the commissioner with sudden bluntness. The official who signed his cards for the sum of 100 credits has confessed, under pressure, and we know more of you than you think. If you are hinting, sire, that the sum we have asked you to accept is inadequate in view of the risks, the commissioner smiled. On the contrary, it is more than adequate. He tossed the bills aside. To return to what I was saying, it is the Emperor himself who has become interested in your case. Is it not true, sirs, that you have recently been guests of General Rios? Is it not true that you have escaped from the midst of his army with, to put it mildly, astonishing ease? Is it not true that you possess a small fortune in bills backed by Lord Broderick's estates? In short, is it not true that you are a pair of spies and assassins sent here to... Well, you shall tell us yourself who paid you and for what. Do you know, said Barr with silky anger, I deny the right of a petty commissioner to accuse us of crimes. We will leave. You will not leave. The commissioner arose, and his eyes no longer seemed nearsighted. You need answer no question now. That will be reserved for a later and more forceful time. Nor am I a commissioner. I am a lieutenant of the Imperial Police. You are under arrest. There was a glitteringly efficient blast gun in his fist as he smiled. There are greater men than you under arrest this day. It is a hornet's nest we are cleaning up. Devers snarled and reached slowly for his own gun. The lieutenant of police smiled more broadly and squeezed the contacts. The blazing line of force struck Devers' chest in an accurate blaze of destruction that bounced harmlessly off his personal shield in sparkling spicules of light. Devers shot in turn, and the lieutenant's head fell from off an upper torso that had disappeared. It was still smiling as it lay in the jag of sunshine which entered through the new-made hole in the wall. It was through the back entrance that they left. Devers said huskily, "Quickly to the ship! They'll have the alarm out in no time!" He cursed in a ferocious whisper. "It's another plan that's backfired! I could swear the space fiend himself is against me!" It was in the open that they became aware of the jabbering crowds that surrounded the huge televisors. They had no time to wait. The disconnected roaring words that reached them, they disregarded. But Barr snatched a copy of the Imperial News before diving into the huge barn of the hangar, where the ship lifted hastily through a giant cavity burnt fiercely into the roof. "Can you get away from them?" asked Barr. 10 ships of the traffic police wildly followed the runaway craft that had burst out of the lawful, radio-beamed path of leaving, and then broken every speed law in creation. Further behind still, sleek vessels of the Secret Service were lifting in pursuit of a carefully described ship, manned by 2 thoroughly identified murderers. "Watch me," said Devers, and savagely shifted into hyperspace, 2,000 miles above the surface of Trantor. The shift, so near a planetary mass, meant unconsciousness for Barr and a fearful haze of pain for Devers, but light years further, space above them was clear. Devers' somber pride in his ship burst to the surface. He said, "There's not an Imperial ship that could follow me anywhere." And then bitterly, "But there's nowhere left to run for us, and we can't fight their weight. What's there to do? What can anyone do?" Barr moved feebly on his cot. The effect of the hypershift had not yet worn off, and each of his muscles ached. He said, "No one has to do anything. It's all over. Here." He passed the copy of the Imperial News that he still clutched, and the headlines were enough for the traitor. "Recalled and arrested. Rios and Broderick," Devers muttered. He stared blankly at Barr. "Why?" "The story doesn't say, but what does it matter? The war with the Foundation is over, and at this moment, Siwena is revolting. Read the story and see." His voice was drifting off. "We'll stop in some of the provinces and find out the later details. If you don't mind, I'll go to sleep now." And he did. In grasshopper jumps of increasing magnitude, The trade ship was spanning the galaxy in its return to the Foundation. Chapter 10. The War Ends. Lathan Devers felt definitely uncomfortable and vaguely resentful. He had received his own decoration and withstood with mute stoicism the turgid oratory of the mayor, which accompanied the slip of crimson ribbon. That had ended his share of the ceremonies, but naturally, formality forced him to remain. And it was formality chiefly, the type that couldn't allow him to yawn noisily or to swing a foot comfortably onto a chair seat, that made him long to be in space, where he belonged. The Siwanese delegation, with Dukembar, a lionized member, signed the convention, and Siwena became the first province to pass directly from the Empire's political rule to the Foundation's economic one. 5 Imperial ships of the line, captured when Siwena rebelled behind the lines of the Emperor's border fleet, flashed overhead, huge and massive, detonating a roaring salute as they passed over the city. Nothing but drinking, etiquette, and small talk now. A voice called him. It was Farrell, the man who, Devers realized coldly, could buy 20 of him with a morning's profits, but a Farrell who now crooked a finger at him with genial condescension. He stepped out upon the balcony into the cool night wind and bowed properly, while scowling into his bristling beard. Barr was there too, smiling. He said, "Devers, you'll have to come to my rescue. I'm being accused of modesty, a horrible and thoroughly unnatural crime." "Devers?" Farrell removed the fat cigar from the side of his mouth when he spoke. "Lord Barr claims that your trip to Cleon's capital had nothing to do with the recall of Rios."
"Nothing at all, sir." Devers was curt. "We never saw the Emperor. The reports we picked up on our way back concerning the trial showed it up to be the purest frame-up. There was a mess of rigmarole about the general being tied up with subversive interests at the court."
"And he was innocent?"
"Rios?" interposed Barr.
"Yes, by the galaxy, yes. Broderick was a traitor on general principles, but was never guilty of the specific accusations brought against him. It was a judicial farce, but a necessary one, a predictable one, an inevitable one."
"By psycho-historical necessity, I presume."
Farrell rolled the phrase sonorously with the humorous ease of long familiarity.
"Exactly."
Barr grew serious. "It never penetrated earlier, but once it was over and I could, well, look at the answers in the back of the book, the problem became quite simple. We can see now that the social background of the Empire makes wars of conquest impossible for it. Under weak emperors, it is torn apart by generals competing for a worthless and surely death-bringing throne. Under strong emperors, the Empire is frozen into a paralytic rigor in which disintegration apparently ceases for the moment, but only at the sacrifice of all possible growth." Farrell growled bluntly through the strong puffs.
"You're not clear, Lord Barr."
Barr smiled slowly.
I suppose so. It's the difficulty of not being trained in psychohistory. Words are a pretty fuzzy substitute for mathematical equations. But let's see now."
Barr considered, while Farrell relaxed, back to railing, and Devers looked into the velvet sky and thought wonderingly of Trantor. Then Barr said,
"You see, sir, you and Devers, and everyone, no doubt, had the idea that beating the Empire meant first prying apart the Emperor and his general. You and Devers and everyone else were right, right all the time, as far as the principle of internal disunion was concerned. You were wrong, however, in thinking that this internal split was something to be brought about by individual acts, by inspirations of the moment. You tried bribery and lies. You appealed to ambition and to fear. But you got nothing for all your pains. In fact, appearances were worse after each attempt. And through all this wild threshing up of tiny ripples, the Selden tidal wave continued onward, quietly, but quite irresistibly." Dukembar turned away and looked over the railing at the lights of a rejoicing city. He said, "There was a dead hand pushing all of us. the mighty general and the great emperor, my world and your world, the dead hand of Harry Seldon. He knew that a man like Rios would have to fail, since it was his success that brought failure, and the greater the success, the surer the failure. Farrell said dryly, I can't say you're getting clearer. A moment, continued Barr earnestly. Look at the situation. A weak general could never have endangered us, obviously. A strong general during the time of a weak emperor would never have endangered us either, for he would have turned his arms towards a much more fruitful target. Events have shown that 3/4 of the emperors of the last 2 centuries were rebel generals and rebel viceroys before they were emperors. So it is only the combination of strong emperor and strong general that can harm the foundation. For a strong emperor cannot be dethroned easily, and a strong general is forced to turn outwards, past the frontiers. But what keeps the emperor strong? What kept Cleon strong? It's obvious. He is strong because he permits no strong objects. A courtier who becomes too rich, or a general who becomes too popular, is dangerous. All the recent history of the empire proves that to any emperor intelligent enough to be strong. Rios won victories, so the emperor grew suspicious. All the atmosphere of the times forced him to be suspicious. Did Rios refuse a bribe? Very suspicious. Ulterior motives. Did his most trusted courtier suddenly favor Rios? Very suspicious. Ulterior motives. It wasn't the individual acts that were suspicious. Anything else would have done, which is why our individual plots were unnecessary and rather futile. It was the success of Rios that was suspicious. So he was recalled and accused, condemned, murdered. The Foundation wins again. Why, look, there is not a conceivable combination of events that does not result in the Foundation winning. It was inevitable, whatever Rios did, whatever we did. The Foundation magnate nodded ponderously. So, but what if the Emperor and the General had been the same person, eh? What then? That's a case you didn't cover, so you haven't proved your point yet. Barr shrugged. I can't prove anything. I haven't the mathematics, but I appeal to your reason. With an empire in which every aristocrat, every strong man, every pirate can aspire to the throne, and as history shows, often successfully, what would happen to even a strong emperor who preoccupied himself with foreign wars at the extreme end of the galaxy? How long would he have to remain away from the capital before somebody raised the standards of civil war and forced him home? The social environment of the empire would make that time short. I once told Rios that not all the empire's strength could swerve the dead hand of Harry Seldon. Good, good. Farrell was expansively pleased. Then you imply the empire can never threaten us again. It seems to me so, agreed Barr. Frankly, Cleon may not live out the year, and there's going to be a disputed succession almost as a matter of course, which might mean the last civil war for the empire. Then, said Farrell, there are no more enemies. Barr was thoughtful. There's a second foundation. At the other end of the galaxy? Not for centuries. Devers turned suddenly at this, and his face was dark as he faced Farrell. There are internal enemies, perhaps. Are there? Asked Farrell coolly. Who, for instance? People, for instance, who might like to spread the wealth a bit and keep it from concentrating too much out of the hands that work for it. See what I mean? Slowly, Farrell's gaze lost its contempt and grew one with the anger of Devers' own. Part 2. The Mule. Chapter 11. Bride and Groom. The Mule. Less is known of the Mule than of any character of comparable significance to galactic history. His real name is unknown, his early life mere conjecture. Even the period of his greatest renown is known to us chiefly through the eyes of his antagonists, and principally through those of a young bride. Encyclopedia Galactica. Beta's first sight of Haven was entirely the contrary of spectacular. Her husband pointed it out, a dull star lost in the emptiness of the galaxy's edge. It was past the last sparse clusters to where straggling points of light gleamed lonely, and even among these, it was poor and inconspicuous. Toran was quite aware that as the earliest prelude to married life, the red dwarf lacked impressiveness, and his lips curled self-consciously. "I know, Bay. It isn't exactly a proper change, is it? I mean, from the foundation to this." "A horrible change, Toran. I should never have married you." And when his face looked momentarily hurt, before he caught himself, she said with her special cozy tone, "All right, silly. Now let your lower lip droop and give me that special dying duck look. The one just before you're supposed to bury your head on my shoulder while I stroke your hair full of static electricity. You were fishing for some drivel, weren't you? You were expecting me to say, 'I'd be happy anywhere with you, Toran,' or 'The interstellar depths themselves would be my home, my sweet, were you but with me.' Now you admit it." She pointed a finger at him and snatched it away an instant before his teeth closed upon it. He said, "If I surrender and admit you're right, will you prepare dinner?" She nodded contentedly. He smiled and just looked at her. She wasn't beautiful on the grand scale to others. He admitted that, even if everybody did look twice. Her hair was dark and glossy, though straight, her mouth a bit wide. But her meticulous, close-textured eyebrows separated a white, unlined forehead from the warmest mahogany eyes ever filled with smiles. And behind, a very sturdily built and staunchly defended facade of practical, unromantic, hard-headedness towards life, there was just that little pool of softness that would never show if you poked for it, but could be reached if you knew just how, and never let on that you were looking for it. Toran adjusted the controls unnecessarily and decided to relax. He was one interstellar jump and then several milli-microparsecs on the straight before manipulation by hand was necessary. He leaned over backwards to look into the storeroom, where Beta was juggling appropriate containers. There was quite a bit of smugness about his attitude towards Beta, the satisfied awe that marks the triumph of someone who has been hovering at the edge of an inferiority complex for 3 years. After all, he was a provincial, and not merely a provincial, but the son of a renegade trader, and she was of the Foundation itself, and not merely that, but she could trace her ancestry back to Mallow. And with all that, a tiny quiver underneath. To take her back to Haven, with its rock world and cave cities, was bad enough. To have her face the traditional hostility of trader for Foundation, nomad for city dweller, was worse. Still, after supper, the last jump. Haven was an angry crimson blaze, and the second planet was a ruddy patch of light with atmosphere blurred rim and a half-sphere of darkness. Beta leaned over the large view table with its spidering crisscross lines that centered Haven 2 neatly. She said gravely, "I wish I had met your father first. If he takes a dislike to me..." "Then," said Toran matter-of-factly, "you would be the first pretty girl to inspire that in him. Before he lost his arm and stopped roving around the galaxy, he... Well, if you ask him about it, he'll talk to you about it until your ears wear down to a nubbin. After a while, I got to thinking that he was embroidering, because he never told the same story twice the same way." Haven 2 was rushing up at them now. The landlocked sea wheeled ponderously below them, slate gray in the lowering dimness and lost to sight, here and there, among the wispy clouds. Mountains jutted raggedly along the coast. The sea became wrinkled with nearness, and as it veered off past the horizon just at the end, there was one vanishing glimpse of shore-hugging ice fields. Toran grunted under the fierce deceleration. "Is your suit locked?" Beta's plump face was round and ruddy in the encasing sponge foam of the internally heated, skin-clinging costume. The ship lowered crunchingly on the open field, just short of the lifting of the plateau. They climbed out awkwardly into the solid darkness of the outer galactic night, and Beta gasped as the sudden cold bit, and the thin wind swirled emptily.
Toran seized her elbow and nudged her into an awkward run over the smooth, packed ground towards the sparkling of artificial light in the distance. The advancing guards met them halfway, and after a whispered exchange of words, they were taken onward. The wind and the cold disappeared when the gate of rock opened and then closed behind them. The warm interior, white with wall light, was filled with an incongruous humming bustle. Men looked up from their desks, and Toran produced documents. They were waved onward after a short glance, and Toran whispered to his wife, "Dad must have fixed up the preliminaries. The usual lapse here is about 5 hours." They burst into the open, and Beta said suddenly, "Oh, my!" The cave city was in daylight, the white daylight of a young sun. Not that there was a sun, of course. What should have been the sky was lost in the unfocused glow of an overall brilliance, and the warm air was properly thick and fragrant with greenery. Beta said, "Why, Toran, it's beautiful." Toran grinned with anxious delight. "Well, now, Bay, it isn't like anything on the Foundation, of course, but it's the biggest city on Haven, too. 20,000 people, you know. And you'll get to like it. No amusement palaces, I'm afraid, but no secret police either." "Oh, Tori, it's just like a toy city. It's all white and pink and so clean." "Well..." Toran looked at the city with her. The houses were 2 stories high for the most part, and of the smooth vein rock indigenous to the region. The spires of the Foundation were missing, and the colossal community houses of the old kingdoms. But the smallness was there, and the individuality, a relic of personal initiative in a galaxy of mass life. He snapped to sudden attention. "Bay, there's Dad, right there, where I'm pointing, silly, don't you see him?" She did. It was just the impression of a large man, waving frantically, fingers spread wide as though groping wildly in air. The deep thunder of a drawn-out shout reached them. Beta trailed her husband, rushing downwards over the close-cropped lawn. She caught sight of a smaller man, white-haired, almost lost to view behind the robust one arm, who still waved and still shouted. Toran cried over his shoulder, "It's my father's half-brother, the one who's been to the Foundation, you know." They met in the grass, laughing and incoherent, and Toran's father let out a final whoop for sheer joy. He hitched at his short jacket and adjusted the metal-chased belt that was his one concession to luxury. His eye shifted from one of the youngsters to the other, and then he said, a little out of breath, "You picked a rotten day to return home, boy." "What? Oh, it is Selden's birthday, isn't it?" "It is. I had to rent a car to make the trip here, and Dragoon Randu to drive it." "Not a public vehicle to be had at gun's point." His eyes were on Beta now, and didn't leave. He spoke to her more softly. "I have the crystal of you right here, and it's good, but I can see the fellow who took it was an amateur." He had the small cube of transparency out of his jacket pocket, and in the light the laughing little face within sprang to vivid colored life as a miniature Beta. "That one," said Beta. "Now I wonder why Toran should send you that caricature. I'm surprised you let it come so near you, sir." "Are you now? Call me Fran. I'll have none of this fancy mess. For that, I think you can take my arm, and we'll go to the car. Till now, I never did think my boy knew what he was ever up to. I think I'll change that opinion. I think I'll have to change that opinion." Toran said to his half-uncle softly, "How is the old man these days? Does he still hound the women?" Randu puckered up all over his face when he smiled.
"When he can, Toran, when he can. There are times when he remembers that his next birthday will be his 60th, and that disheartens him. But he shouts it down, this evil thought, and then he is himself. He is a traitor of the ancient type. But you, Toran, where did you find such a pretty wife?"
The young man chuckled and linked arms.
"Do you want a 3 years' history at a gasp, Uncle?"
It was in the small living room of the home that Beta struggled out of her traveling cloak and hood and shook her hair loose. She sat down, crossing her knees, and returned the appreciative stare of this large, ruddy man. She said,
"I know what you're trying to estimate, and I'll help you. Age 24, height 5'4",
Weight 110, educational specialty history. She noticed that he always crooked his stand so as to hide the missing arm. But now Fran leaned close and said, "Since you mention it, weight 120. He laughed loudly at her flush. Then he said to the company in general, "You can always tell a woman's weight by her upper arm. With due experience, of course. Do you want a drink, Bay?" "Among other things," she said, and they left together, while Taran busied himself at the bookshelves to check for new editions. Fran returned alone and said, "She'll be down later." He lowered himself heavily into the large corner chair and placed his stiff-jointed left leg on the stool before it. The laughter had left his red face, and Taran turned to face him. Fran said, "Well, you're home, boy, and I'm glad you are. I like your woman. She's no whining ninny." "I married her," said Taran simply. "Well, that's another thing altogether, boy." His eyes darkened. "It's a foolish way to tie up the future. In my longer life and more experienced, I never did such a thing." Randu interrupted from the corner where he stood quietly. "Now, Fransart, what comparisons are you making? Till your crash landing 6 years ago, you were never in one spot long enough to establish residence requirements for marriage. And since then, who would have you?" The one-armed man jerked erect in his seat and replied hotly, "Many, you snowy dotard," Taran said with hasty tact. "It's largely a legal formality, Dad, that the situation has its conveniences." "Mostly for the women," grumbled Fran. "And even if so," argued Randu, "it's up to the boy to decide. Marriage is an old custom among the Foundationers." "The Foundationers are not fit models for an honest trader," smoldered Fran. Taran broke in again. "My wife is a Foundationer." He looked from one to the other, and then said quietly, "She's coming." The conversation took a general turn after the evening meal, which Fran had spiced with three tales of reminiscence composed of equal parts of blood, women, prophets, and embroidery. The small televisor was on, and some classic drama was playing itself out in an unregarded whisper. Randu had hitched himself into a more comfortable position on the low couch and gazed past the slow smoke of his long pipe to where Beta had knelt down upon the softness of the white fur mat, brought back once long ago from a trade mission, and now spread out only upon the most ceremonious occasions. "You have studied history, my girl?" he asked pleasantly. Beta nodded. "I was the despair of my teachers, but I learned a bit eventually." "A citation for scholarship," put in Taran smugly. "That's all." "And what did you learn?" proceeded Randu smoothly. This book is continued on cassette number 4. "Everything? Now?" laughed the girl. The old man smiled gently. "Well, then, what do you think of the galactic situation?"
"I think," said Beta concisely, "that a Selden crisis is pending, and that if it isn't, then away with the Selden plan altogether. It is a failure."
"Phew," muttered Fran from his corner. "What a way to speak of Selden." But he said nothing aloud. Randu sucked at his pipe speculatively.
"Indeed. Why do you say that? I was to the Foundation, you know, in my younger days, and I, too, once thought great dramatic thoughts. But now, why do you say that?"
"Well," Beta's eyes misted with thought as she curled her bare toes into the white softness of the rug and nestled her little chin in one plump hand. "It seems to me that the whole essence of Selden's plan was to create a world better than the ancient one of the Galactic Empire. It was falling apart, that world, 3 centuries ago, when Selden first established the Foundation. And if history speaks truly, it was falling apart of the triple disease of inertia, despotism, and maldistribution of the goods of the universe." Randu nodded slowly, while Taran gazed with proud, luminous eyes at his wife. And Fran in the corner clucked his tongue and carefully refilled his glass. Beta said, "If the story of Selden is true, he foresaw the complete collapse of the Empire through his laws of psychohistory, and was able to predict the necessary 30,000 years of barbarism before the establishment of a new Second Empire to restore civilization and culture to humanity.
It was the whole aim of his life work to set up such conditions as would ensure a speedier rejuvenation. The deep voice of Fran burst out. And that's why he established the two foundations. Honor be to his name. And that's why he established the two foundations, assented Beta. Our foundation was a gathering of the scientists of the dying empire, intended to carry on the science and learning of man to new heights. And the foundation was so situated in space, and the historical environment was such that, through the careful calculations of his genius, Selden foresaw that in 1,000 years, it would become a newer, greater empire. There was a reverent silence. The girl said softly, It's an old story, you all know it. For almost 3 centuries, every human being of the Foundation has known it. But I thought it would be appropriate to go through it, just quickly. Today is Selden's birthday, you know. And even if I am of the Foundation, and you are of the Haven, we have that in common. She lit a cigarette slowly and watched the glowing tip absently. The laws of history are as absolute as the laws of physics, and if the probabilities of error are greater, it is only because history does not deal with as many humans as physics does atoms, so that individual variations count for more. Selden predicted a series of crises through the 1,000 years of growth, each of which would force a new turning of our history into a pre-calculated path. It is those crises which direct us, and therefore a crisis must come now. Now, she repeated forcefully. It's almost a century since the last one, and in that century every vice of the empire has been repeated in the foundation. Inertia. Our own ruling class knows one law. No change. Despotism. They know one rule. Force. Maldistribution. They know one desire, to hold what is theirs. While others starve, roared Fran suddenly with a mighty blow of his fist upon the arm of his chair. Girl, your words are pearls. The fat guts on their money bags ruin the foundation, while the brave traders hide their poverty on dregs of worlds like Haven. It's a disgrace to Selden, a casting of dirt in his face, a spewing in his beard. He raised his arm high, and then his face lengthened. If I had my other arm, if once they had listened to me. Dad, said Toran, take it easy. Take it easy. Take it easy, his father mimicked savagely. We'll live here and die here forever, and you say take it easy. That's our modern Lathan Devers, said Randu, gesturing with his pipe. This Fran of ours. Devers died in the slave mines 80 years ago with your husband's great-grandfather because he lacked wisdom and didn't lack heart. Yes, by galaxy, I'd do the same if I were he, swore Fran. Devers was the greatest trader in history, greater than the overblown windbag Mallow, the Foundationer's worship. If the cutthroats who lord the Foundation killed him because he loved justice, the greater the blood debt owed them. Go on, girl, said Randu. Go on, or surely he'll talk all the night and rave all the next day. There's nothing to go on about, she said with a sudden gloom. There must be a crisis, but I don't know how to make one. The progressive forces on the Foundation are opposed fearfully. You traitors may have the will, but you are hunted and disunited. If all the forces of goodwill in and out of the Foundation could combine... Fran's laugh was a raucous jeer. Listen to her, Randu, listen to her. In and out of the Foundation, she says. Girl, girl, there's no hope in the flab sides of the Foundation. Among them some hold the whip and the rest are whipped, dead whipped. Not enough spunk left in the whole rotten world to outface one good traitor. Beta's attempted interruptions broke feebly against the overwhelming wind. Toran leaned over and put a hand over her mouth. Dad, he said coldly, you've never been on the Foundation. You know nothing about it. I tell you that the underground there is brave and daring enough. I could tell you that Beta was one of them. All right, boy, no offense. Now where's the cause for anger? He was genuinely perturbed. Toran drove on fervently. The trouble with you, Dad, is that you've got a provincial outlook. You think because some 100,000 traders scurry into holes on an unwanted planet at the end of nowhere that they're a great people. Of course, any tax collector from the Foundation that gets here never leaves again, but that's cheap heroism. What would you do if the Foundation sent a fleet? We'd blast them, said Fran sharply, and get blasted, with the balance in their favor. You're outnumbered, outarmed, outorganized. And as soon as the Foundation thinks it worth its while, you'll realize that. So you'd better seek your allies on the Foundation itself if you can.